Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the drama teacher Anna Scher. When she set up her theatre school in London more than four decades ago, children queued round the block to get in. Cathy Burke, Martin Kemp and Pauline Quirk were among those who handed over their 10p pieces every week, and the cast of EastEnders would have been sadly depleted without a long line of Scher's graduates. It's more than 10 years since depression forced her to step down, but when she tried to return, there was no job for her leading the organisation which bore her name, so she started again, set up a new school and recruited a new group of teenagers. "Teaching is the love of my life," she says. "Teaching is everything for me. It's my raison d'être." I'm wondering, Anna Scher, what do you say to those young, eager teenagers who come through the doors for the first time dreaming of their leading role in Oliver or a starring part in EastEnders?
Well, I give them the ground rules that we start with discipline, but our staple is improvisation, and that makes for very believable actors. We have many actors over the years in EastEnders, and that's the way to do it, I think, you know.
How old are the kids?
Well, we start them at 6, and then we go up to people in their 60s. There's no upper age limit.
And do they come in with, I'm wondering if they, and sometimes with their parents slightly nudging them from behind, do they come in with stars in their eyes? Do they think, ah, yes, this is the woman who makes the stars who get on the telly?
That used to be, but not so much now. I think they come for the sake of the class, and there's a lot of bonhomie in the classes that we run. They've no illusions as to how overcrowded the theatre is.
I wonder what you make of the current culture for, you know, the sort of Britain's Got Talent, X Factor, all those kind of shows that, you know, pull in tens of millions each weekend. They do encourage youngsters to think that there's a quicker road to fame, that, you know, if you just get in front of Simon Cowell, riches will be yours.
Yes.
What do you make of all of that?
Well, I don't like to see the pressure on the children, but I do enjoy the shows.
You do enjoy the shows?
Yes,
that's interesting.
I do.
What do you enjoy about them?
Well, I enjoy the critiques, but I like it to be constructive criticism, not destructive.
It's interesting that in this current X Factor series, Gary Barlow, who has been there, seen it, done it, says that he does worry about children being just not quite mature enough to take the criticism. What's your perspective on that?
I agree with Gary Barlow. I think to be hurt publicly is not a good thing.
And what about you when you see the people who've come up through the ranks of your classes, you see them on stage or on television, and how do you feel?
Oh, very proud. I'm like a proud mum.
We're going to go to the music, of course, Anna Scher. Tell me what we're going to hear first of all today.
This is Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison.
And why have you chosen this?
Oh, it's a wonderful, tuneful tune, and it makes it for a very good warm-up.
When the rains came down in the hollow, playing a new game, laughing and a running, hey, hey, skipping and a jumping in the misty morning fog with our hearts a thumping and you.
That was Van Morrison and Brown Eyed Girl. You chose it, Anna Scher, just really because it's a fabulous piece of music. But you did have, I understand, an encounter with Van Morrison.
Yes, I did.
What happened?
We were both doing the Gloria Hunniford show. And one of my sayings is, the smile is stronger than the scowl. I was feeling particularly smiley, so I tried the smile-scowl test on Van and failed miserably.
What is the smile-scowl test?
Well, let me try it on you.
Okay.
If you just give me a scowl and look into my eyes and I give you a smile and you see it wins.
And I actually was trying quite hard there.
Well, there you are.
But he didn't. He didn't
want to know.
When I was preparing to talk to you today, I read a lot about you saying it was important to diffuse anger and, you know, sort of reconciliation, and words that I wouldn't really have expected to be associated with, well, you know, just a drama class. Do you find with your children then that anger's sometimes quite close to the surface, that you have to get rid of it?
Well, they get rid of their anger by doing improvisations.
Right.
And then we have an olive branch where they reconcile.
Do they start shouting quite easily? Is that where people go when you ask them to improvise?
Yes.
They become dramatic?
Yes, that's right. And then we do an olive branch to make up.
Explain more to me about that.
Well, peace studies play a part. I've done peace workshops all over the world, integrating, say, Catholic and Protestants, when I was in Northern Ireland and did some peace workshops there.
It would be easy to be sniffy about it. It would be easy to say drama, peace workshops, in places that are in, you know, the greatest turmoil imaginable. What difference, tangible difference, do you see them make?
Enjoyment is the key.
Right.
And it's integration through improvisation. So with the with Rwanda, I integrated Hutus and Tutsis.
This would literally be in a class? You would have people from both ethnic groups there, would you?
Yes.
How would you even get them there?
Well, I have a facilitator. He comes with me and does the workshops with me. I use peace people as a reference point. My great heroes are Martin Luther King, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Anne Frank. And we use those as the reference point, and we base the workshops around them.
I'm wondering if the people who come along to your workshops, in a sense you are preaching to the converted, you are speaking to the Hutu who is predisposed towards sitting in a room with a Tutsi, the ones that you maybe need to get to are the ones who won't come.
Well, I don't worry too much about that. As I said, enjoyment is the keynote, and they love the high standards. They absolutely, every place I've been to. When I went to Israel, I integrated Jews and Arabs in a bomb shelter. As I said, you have to have a facilitator to set up the location and so on.
And how do you get there? Do you sort of just turn up with your facilitator and give it a go?
I get invited. Northern Ireland, I've been over there about 7 times. I think it stays in their mind. It stays in their mind.
And what about being the moral arbiter? Do any of your students ever say to you, well, who are you? Who are you to tell me how I should be? I'm here to learn to act, Anna. I'm not here to sort of listen to you tell me what you think's important.
Well, improvisation is the staple. So they just fall into it by nature. When I started as a school's drama club in 1968 now, there was an enormous class. There was about 70 in the class.
Right.
And a lot of those people were non-readers. So I fell into improvisation by chance. And I found that that was a very effective way of character training.
Let's have some more music then. Tell me what we're going to hear as disc number 2.
Sunrise, Sunset, from the soundtrack to Fiddler on the Roof.
And particularly, why have you chosen this?
Because I find it a very moving piece of music. And Topol, I think he's got so much charisma and empathy in his voice and compassion. I really love it.
That was Sunrise, Sunset, the cast recording from Fiddler on the Roof. So, Anna Sher, let's go back then. You were born in Cork. It was 1944. Jewish-Lithuanian family, which sounds interesting. Tell me what you remember of those very early years.
Well, I believe I've got green blood. I love Ireland. I went to a convent school. In fact, I had the dubious distinction of being the only Jewish girl in the convent school. And I used to go tap dancing. I really loved it, singing and dancing. It was my life. Life was bliss. there.
What did you like about it? What did you like about being on stage when you were little?
I just loved it. I really loved it. And I loved doing the pantomimes every year. And I used to count the Christmas trees on the way to Cork Opera House where we did them. In fact, Cork Opera House, I was in it the night it burned down.
Goodness me. Yes. You were performing or
luckily it was rehearsals. It burned to the ground. I mean, we all got out safe and sound.
How old would you have been?
I must have been 12.
Goodness me, so that must be seared on your consciousness, is it?
Yes, it is. I remember looking up at the amber sky. The whole sky was amber. And that was the end of the Cork Opera House.
What about lessons? Did you enjoy lessons too?
Oh, yes, I did. I loved it at the convent school. And I lived there till I was 14, and then the family moved to Hove in Brighton.
And you said you had the distinction of being the only Jewish girl in the convent. Were you aware you were the only Jewish girl in the convent?
Oh, yes, I was, because I went to synagogue on a Saturday, and I didn't attend the Catholic prayers at school, you know, so I was made very clear. I had two cultures to embrace, the Irish and the Jewish.
Describe to me a little bit more about Cork in the late 1940s. What sort of a town was it to live in?
Oh, it was lovely. The nuns were so kind. And there was a massive moral compass there. And it seemed as if people were happy and wanting to do their best. I have a memory of Cork when we left. The Innisfallen boat took us to England, and I looked out, and there were all my class with their green uniforms waving goodbye to me. And I was absolutely in tears, floods of tears, because I'd left Cork.
We'll take a break now for some music then, Anisha. Right. Tell me what we're going to hear now. We're on your third disc today.
This is Bob Marley and One Love.
And why have you chosen this?
I've chosen it because when I do my peace workshops, this is the song that all the children seem to love.
That was Bob Marley and One Love. So, Anna Sher, you were the eldest of four girls. When you were little, how did you get on in this busy house?
We got on brilliantly. We had a very strict father.
Right. What was allowed? What was not allowed?
Well, he called me a good time girl because I loved going out and dancing. But he insisted I became a teacher before an actress. And he said, no daughter of mine shall ever be an actress. You'd become socially useful and become a teacher first, which of course I'm very grateful that I did become a teacher first, because I think acting I would not be right for.
Why not?
Well, I think I would have been rejected.
Too many casting directors telling you to go away.
Yes.
And do you think he actually saw something in you that he thought would be useful as a teacher? Do you think he also recognised that?
Yes, I think he probably did. But, I mean, his view was no daughter of his was going to be a good-for-nothing actress. He wanted me to be a dentist, like him. He came from a family of four dentists. And he used to bring these prospective teenage dentists to meet me, to our mutual embarrassment.
What, as suitable suitors?
Yes, that's right.
Right.
Yes.
And what did he think of having four girls in the house?
Oh, I think he found it pretty stressful, even though I think we were very well behaved. But he took his responsibilities very seriously. And, you know, he gave us a very good education and a nice home.
And tell me, in the early years, tell me about your mother. When you were a little girl, what are your memories of your mum?
Mum was very easy to get on with, and she made the costumes for us to wear at the tap dancing classes. And she wanted me to do the pantomimes and things. You know, she was very talented with her hands.
So the difference between her and your father was she quite liked a little bit of showbiz, did she?
Yes, she did.
Right.
She did. And there was arguments as to whether I would do the pantomime every year, and she always defended me. But as I said, with Mum and Dad, I was the thorn between two roses rather than rose between two thorns. But Mum, bless her, won the day.
And did it make for, I mean, between your parents, was it genuinely tense? I mean, were there proper arguments about it, or it was really, you know, just a bit of jesting?
Oh, they were pretty tense. I remember there were terrible arguments about it. But, I mean, to be fair to Dad, I think, you know, he was worried that I would be an actress, and he knew how precarious it was.
Yes, and also, around about that time, it was a profession with a sort of disreputable reputation, it would be fair to say.
Yes, I think it would be.
It was certain sorts who were attracted to that, and they probably weren't dentist's daughters.
Very well put, Kirsty.
Let's have some more music then. Well, in fact, it's not music now. Tell us what we're going to hear now. We're on your fourth disc of the day.
This is part of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
And why have you chosen this?
Well, Martin Luther King is one of my great heroes. And when I do my peace workshops all over the world and in class, I incorporate them in my drama classes. And Martin Luther King had such passion in his voice. Yolanda King, his daughter, who's sadly not with us now, came to our 30th birthday, and we put on Martin Luther King's speech, and we held hands and walked through the theatre like sisters. And that was the most memorable moment in my life. And Martin Luther King, it was like his spirit was there.
For rights reasons, we're unable to bring you this choice. That was part of Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream, delivered on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in March 1963. It was a very poignant image, Anna Sher, that you shared with us earlier on of waving goodbye to your school chums. You were in your early teens, were you, about 14?
I was 14,
You were 14, and you were travelling to Hove?
Yes.
And why? Why did the family uproot itself?
Well, I think my father felt that we would have more educational opportunities in England. And I didn't want to go, certainly, and Mum didn't want to go either. But that's what we did, because go we must.
Was it the sort of family, I mean, you've mentioned tensions in the family, were you able to say to your mum and dad, I don't want to go, why are you making me go, or did you just buckle down and get on with it?
I buckled down and got on with it, yeah.
And there came a point when the family essentially broke up, your mother left. At what point did that happen?
That happened, I think, about a year later.
Did you have any warning of that?
No, but it was extraordinary because I went to school the day she left, and I had a terrible feeling something was wrong. So I begged the headmistress, Miss Brown, to let me go home.
Right.
And I came home, and there was the inevitable note on the table. And I contacted my dad, and she was gone. And anyway, she left, and she had a child. Dad was devastated. The child, however, you know, my sisters and I have met him, and he is just adorable. He really is.
Even now, it's almost one of the last taboos, a mother to up and leave her brood. At the time, how did your mother explain it to you? Did you talk to her about why she'd done it?
She said she'd never forgotten, you know, because we met up with her years later.
How many years later?
About 6 years later.
You didn't see her at all for 6 years?
No.
And when she told you that she had thought about you every day, was that enough?
You see, I could never blame her in any way. I'm not into blame anyway, but he was difficult to live with.
And did she go on and make a whole new life? She had, a son. And
that's right. She made a new life with her son. I mean, he's now 40 or so. He has turned out just an example, as the nuns would put it. Very, very gentle, lovely young man.
And so you were reconciled with your mother after 6 years?
Yes,
and you
yes.
didn't blame her. What about your other sisters? How did they feel?
Well, my father called it the family tragedy. And he was very, very upset, terribly upset.
How did you come to be reconciled, given that you say it was a period of 6 years? From
approximately, yes.
Yes. How did you come to actually meet up with your mother again? Can you remember?
I don't know. I just did some research. I mean, there weren't computers and things then.
Yes.
I think I made a few calls and we met up in Victoria Station and we both passed each other in the station, not realising. And she always had a very good sense of humour. She said, "What took you so long?" But, you know, we met up and my other sisters met her in due course. I was the first one. She was very sad. It was very hard for her. It was very hard for her.
You've gone on, of course, to be a mother yourself. We will talk about your son later, but when you became a mother, did it cause you to look differently upon what your own mother had done?
I put it down to Dad being very tricky. As I said, I don't blame her at all.
It's time now, Anna Sher, for our next piece of music. We're on disc number 5. What is it and why have you chosen it?
Buddy Holly and Raining in My Heart. I love Buddy Holly. And when he died, I kept a lone vigil in front of his photograph in Woolworths in Cork, and that was 1959. And there was just me and him. Terribly upsetting, but so memorable.
The sun is out, the sky is blue, there's not a cloud to spoil the view, but it's raining, raining in my heart. The weatherman says clear today, he doesn't know you've gone away, and it's raining, raining in my heart.
That was Buddy Holly and Raining in My Heart. You were in raptures there, Anna Sher, throughout all of that, back at the window in Woolworths in Cork.
Yes.
So tell me about it. It started just as a lunchtime drama club. You'd become a teacher. You were teaching English and drama, enjoying it, and then you started this lunchtime drama club.
Yes.
Started with how many people?
70. And improvisation was the staple from the beginning because many of the children were non-readers, and this was a quicker and fairer way to get round all the class so that every voice gets heard.
And when did the Lunchtime Drama Club become the Anna Sher Theatre School?
Well, I ran it for 2 years, and then the children that were leaving at 11 to go on to their secondary schools were coming back to me. So the drama club was too big for the school. So I found a hall across the road from the school and I stayed on at the school as an English and drama teacher. And I took the drama club outside the school.
And it would be fair to say, I mean, the school was a huge success. I'm going to do a little roll call of people who've been through your school. We've got the Kemp brothers, Gary and Martin Kemp.
That's right.
Patsy Palmer from EastEnders, Susan Tully, who was in Grange Hill, and then EastEnders. There's Pauline Quirk and Linda Robson, two of the three birds of a feather. And also you've gone on to write as well stacks of books on the subject of acting. Once you started the theatre school, did you feel that you'd really hit your stride? Did you think, this is what I was meant to be doing, I love this?
I did, really, yes, I did. And of course, Kathy Burke, who is an absolute angel. She's just... I'm just full of praise for her. She's fantastic. But they all were, and many more.
Can you remember the first time Kathy Burke came through your swing doors?
Well, she came into the juniors, and I saw this wonderful girl that was bright as a button and talent absolutely flowing out of her.
So the school was a big success. Then it was, what, just over 10 years ago now that you realised that you were unwell. What happened?
I got depression. Depression is an illness, and with illness you can often get better. So I just was hoping and praying that I'd come out of it.
And at the time, what I read an interview with you where you said, you know, you were one of those people who was sort of up at 6 a.m. and straight into work and full of energy and a real powerhouse. What was the difference when you got ill? How did you feel?
I felt I couldn't get up. It was terrible because I couldn't control it. It was a shocking feeling.
Did it come completely out of the blue, or had you had episodes of depression before?
I had depression before.
Right.
Routine, but not rut. That's what I applied to myself. Just keeping to a good daily routine. Inch by inch, life's a cinch, yard by yard, it's very hard. So I just took one day at a time.
Let's have some music then. We're on our 6th disc for the day, Anna. Tell me about that.
This is dedicated to Ireland and two very dear friends in my life, Carl Diamond and Alan Mills. So it's Danny Boy sung by Carl Diamond, accompanied by Alan Mills.
Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside. The summer's gone and all the roses falling. Tis you must go and I must fly.
That was Danny Boy, sung by Carl Diamond, accompanied by Alan Mills, both of them your friends and colleagues over the years, Anna Scher. We were talking a moment ago about this episode of depression that you suffered, and you said latterly that I was in such terrible mental pain that it became physical. I felt like a block of cement. That's very descriptive.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's true.
You'd resigned from the theatre school that you set up, and you returned 2 years later. When you did return, your position had been filled. That must have been, I can only imagine, a very distressing time, was it?
Yes, it was very stressful. And I wanted my old position back, which was principal.
The people who by then were running the school, the board members, of course, they're not here to share their version of events. You entered into what was a protracted battle. And one of the letters that you were sent, as I understand it, you were advised that, and I'm quoting directly here, classes cannot be used as a platform to advance issues such as peace studies, discrimination studies, or the like. One of the issues was that they felt you weren't concentrating on the things that an acting school should be concentrating on. Is that fair?
Well, they weren't really enamoured with peace studies. They wanted me to put all my classes through the new director and onto the board.
Do you think, I mean, some people might say, well, you know, maybe they had a point. Actually, maybe peace studies do not belong in a theatre school. Maybe it's better to just sort of stick to what people expect to learn when they come through the doors of a theatre school. How would you respond to that?
Well, basically, this is how I do it. You know, the students weren't complaining. And these are classes which, for 32 years, they seem to be fine about. I feel it was unfair.
And you had the gumption, the steely determination, having recovered, to start all over again. That must have taken a lot of energy.
Not really. You know, it's up and running now, and it's okay, but I miss the old building very much.
And what about your husband? Did he support you in starting over again?
He was very supportive. He's an adjudicator for our Festival of Plays 3 times a year, and he runs drama classes himself.
Time to hear some more of your choices then, Anna Scher. Tell me what we're going to hear as your 7th choice today.
When You Are Old by W.B. Yeats, read by T.P. McKenna. Yeats is a wonderful poet, Ireland's number one poet, and it's very touching.
And poetry is a big part of
yes.
your life. You use poetry in your classes, do you?
Yes, I do. Every day we have poems.
Let's hear this piece.
When you are old and grey and full of sleep, and nodding by the fire. Take down this book, and slowly read, and dream of the soft look your eyes had once, and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace, and loved your beauty with love, false or true. But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you, and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And, bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur, a little sadly, how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead, and hid his face amid a crowd of stars.
That was When You Are Old by W.B. Yeats, read by T.P. McKenna. Anna Sher, you've mentioned in passing a couple of times your husband. How involved has Charles been in your business of theatre school over the years?
Very involved. We worked together in the main school for many years. He's now back being an adjudicator for our Festival of Plays, and he does a brilliant job.
Is it true, all those years ago, that you proposed to him?
I think I did.
Were you just tired of waiting?
Well, I think we were happy as we were partners. And
was there a little bit of your father's voice? Well, you're the dentist's daughter, I'm wondering.
You could well be right.
And you have a son together.
Yes, John.
He's in his early 30s, is he?
He's
just 30?
31.
He's 31.
31, yes.
And did he ever, as a much younger boy, did he come along to your classes ever?
He did, but it wasn't for him.
What did he say?
You're not like you are.
Ah.
Mm, I know.
Interesting.
Yes. My persona maybe was not the person he knew.
Right. That's interesting. There'll be no children, or indeed 60-year-old students, on this island where I'm about to maroon you two. How would you cope on the island, do you think?
I'm afraid very badly.
Would you?
Mm.
Why is that?
I'm not good at DIY.
Right.
There'd be no Charles to ask, how do you do it? So I think I would fail miserably.
You don't think you'd employ the old inch by inch, it's a cinch?
I just don't think I could, Kirsty. I would just lie down and wait for that boat to pick me up.
Fair dues. Let's have your final piece today then, Anna Sher. What are we going to hear as disc number 8?
Red Dragon and Compliments on Your Kiss.
And you've chosen this, why?
Well, it's a feature at the Anna Sher Theatre. We have it at the end of the class. And I ask different people to compliment who they want in the group and why it was they were so good. So it's a lovely way of complimenting someone and getting some constructive criticism across. And then we have this music underneath. And then the recipient of the compliment says thank you. And teachers have told me that they've tried this in class and it's worked like a dream.
Compliments, girl, on your kiss. You're number one, girl, on my list. And every time I think of you, I wish. Mm-hmm. I wish that you could have been my girl. I would have taken you around the world. Every time I think of you, I wish.
Hey, hey. Ooh, your sexy body.
That was Red Dragon and Compliments on Your Kiss. So, Anna Sher, I'm going to give you the books now, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. You're allowed to take one other along. What are you going to take?
I'd like to take Poem for the Day, which has got 360 poems, old and new.
Right, you may have
so that. So you have
then.
A poem every day.
You may have that. And a luxury too. What would your luxury be?
I'm very, very keen on Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like a statue of him.
Ah, I thought you were going to say you'd like him, and I was going to say, no, you can certainly have the statue.
And his right arm is in a position like a high five.
Right, in the statue.
In the statue.
I've got you.
That's right. And then I would come along and I would high five him and it would trigger off his famous laugh.
Right, so this is a bespoke statue then. This is not one that exists.
No.
Right, we shall have that made for you. Sounds splendid. And if you had to choose just one of these eight discs, which one disc would you choose?
It would be Bob Marley and One Love, because it always reminds me of the children I teach, and it brings me right across the world.
It's yours. Anna Sher, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.